And again, we have Dr. Senator Hoffman, Senator Olson, Senator Dyson, Senator Stedman, Senator Co-Chair Wilkin, and myself, Senator Green. And Senator Bundy will be right with us. We also have in the room Senator Gary Stevens, Senator Ben Stevens. We've had various visitors throughout the day. I'll try to recognize them as they come in. And certainly want to be sure everyone has full access to this meeting and getting all the information. And now we have Senator Bundy. And at this morning's meeting, there were some requests made for some information. Dan, you want to come up and kind of maybe walk us through? And one of the things Senator Bundy had asked for was that fourth column, so you can kind of see out there what in the far right, it was the second page, it sort of lines out that there are certainly some areas where there are changes, but a number that are identical or near identical. And so that kind of lines it out, so you can kind of look those things up as you see fit. And then you might want to, if you're so inclined, zero in on the things that aren't quite, that are still white. And you can find those things that have changed. Okay, Dan, you want to start at the beginning and walk us through these, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dan Dickinson, for the record, and I am a consultant with the Governor's Office. What we have here is a number of things we put together to analyze this CS. It's not everything that was requested this morning. We'll take some of it. We'll take some time to get to you tomorrow. But what I'd like to do in this package is start out, basically, there's a lot of pieces, and a lot of pieces have been moving between the various bills, and I thought it would be a sort of a clean way to give a very simple structure to the bill and how it's calculated. Perhaps tomorrow, if you'll indulge me, I'll actually have one that has some pictures with numbers attached to it to walk through the same thing, get an order of magnitude about what some of these things are. But basically, I just have four boxes here, and what happens in the Senate Finance Bill, or the Senate Finance CS, is you start out by calculating the tax base. And of course, in this bill, that will be the base for several things. But you start with a gross value at the point of production, which is a similar place to the current tax regime. What we have added in this bill is the fact that we may, for administrative simplicity, try to use a royalty settlement agreement. That language has not changed between this bill and the resources CS. The next step is you take a gas revenue exclusion, and I'll spend some more time on that, but that's clearly something that is new in this CS. And you subtract all their lease expenditures to arrive at production tax value. And that terminology is the same as in the resources CS. So the tax base is the production tax value. Against now, you come to apply the tax rates. And there are three tax rates. There's a base PPT rate, which is 22.5%, and you apply that against the production tax value that we just calculated. I'm going to skip down a line for a minute and go down to the progressivity factor. There is a progressivity factor that is applied against that same tax base, and that factor is driven by the value of the oil after all expenses have been taken care of. And I'll have some graphs on this later. And then the third thing to go back up a line is the private royalty rate, where again we have broken out a piece here that is applicable only to private royalties, and I'll have some information on that later as well. But again, the first step was you calculate the tax base. The second step is you apply these rates against it. So now you know what your total tax liability would be before credits. Then we apply, or there's the possibility of applying five different credits to reduce the ultimate tax liability. The first one is a 5,000 barrel a day equivalent, a credit for 5,000 barrels a day of production. However, that is capped at, that should say 14 million, not 14,000 million. It's not capped at 14 billion. A little bit carried away there. But it is capped at $14 million. That's also non-transferable, so it has that same effect, if you will, with some important differences as the governor's $73 million allowance. The second credit that's available is a credit for transitional investment expenditures, and that, again, as it was in the Senate resources, is equal to half of a current investment with some other limits. The third credit, and it's one that I think people have been very focused on, the third credit here is the alternative exploration credit, which could be up to 40% for a rank exploration well, and that's merely extending the terms of SB 185. The fourth one is the one that people have been very focused on, the qualified capital expenditure in prior bill or prior versions. It's been 20%. The CS before you has a 25% qualified capital expenditure rate in it. And then the final credit is any loss at the end of a year converted to a carry-forward credit. Typically, this would be an explorer or someone who is out doing work but doesn't necessarily have any production yet. So these are the five credits that get applied. I think one of the things that's very important to think about in the structure of this bill, a number of these credits were allowances or deductions in prior bills, and they sort of moved back and forth. If you're going to be applying the progressivity rate and you're going to be applying the PPT base rate, I think that the notion behind this was, let's take these various additional incentives or pieces and we'll turn them into credits. So you calculate sort of your base gross taxable value and the only adjustment that's in there is the tax revenue exclusion. Once that's done, these various things which are focusing on encouraging various kinds of investment or various kinds of taxpayers, all are credits that get applied against that base. So I think it's a cleaner structure to look at it, breaking those pieces all out of credits. Finally, the last box shows the estimated monthly payments. They have to be trued up each year by March 31st. If in fact you underestimate, so you pay say 94%, interest would be due on the amount of the underpayment. And the other thing this bill does is it cleans that up in the sense that there's only one calculation of your total obligation under your PPT, under the progressivity, under the tax on the private royalties. So altogether, those have to sum to 95. It's not like one could be over and one could be under and one would be bearing interest. So I think this bill simplifies that. And finally, the last piece in here is that the taxpayer can use either the annualized or monthly actual costs, and can opt for a whole year. I mean, they can say they're going to do this at any time, but it has to apply for the whole year. It has to be the same for each tax type. Again, or each application. So we have all these various calculations. I think if you think for a minute about the progressivity piece, because it's now on net, and the amount of the progressivity is going to be dependent on how much profit's being generated, it now becomes very sensitive to investments. So if I have a month in which the let's say the price moves $10 between 2 months, whether I made an investment in the lower priced month or the higher priced month is now going to affect my tax rate. And so the concern was that we not get in a situation as an administrator, we certainly don't want to be in a situation where we've got to pin every dollar down to every month as opposed to a year. We think this is a way that deals with this issue fairly. The taxpayer will always know its maximum liability. It can pay on a monthly based on its expenses to date. And in fact, at the end of the year, if it looks back and says, gee, I want to annualize everything and it comes out with a lower value, that's also allowed. But the taxpayer knows their liability. They won't be surprised by a larger liability later in the year. They can estimate it, and we hope that in many situations we won't have to look at month-by-month expenses, but instead they'll be annualized. So this is kind of an overall view of the structure and how this bill, this CS, fits in with that.
Are there any questions?
Okay. Madam Chair, the second page is I think something you've seen before with three columns. We added a fourth column, which basically looks at this draft at the Senate CS. You went through many of the things earlier. Maybe the coloring system on here basically shows which things have not changed between bills and which ones have. The darker yellow implies that there's pretty much no change. Lighter implies that there has been some adjustment, but the net effect may be the same where there was some language change. Shall I just go through them quickly?
Are there any questions about any of these lines? You might just want to go through and explain again.
I'll tick them off as we go down. Not necessarily spending time in order of importance. Obviously, the first two lines are critical effects, which have been different in different versions, and I won't dwell on those at the moment.
I have a question on the second one, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Altman.
On the first time that I've seen the 25% credit, and that is, we've been discussing 20% in the governor's bill, the House resources and the Senate resources, and why is there a benefit for us to have a higher credit, or is it just the policy call? It seems to be quite high.
If the makers want to talk about it, I can certainly speak about the administration's view on that. And I'll give you two views. I mean, the first one is, if you're trying to retain the balance that I think the 2020 struck, you raise the tax rate, it's also appropriate to raise the credit rate. Unfortunately, it's not a simple thing, because as you raise them both, you introduce more volatility. The highs get higher, the lows get lower, if you might. We certainly don't believe that plugging in a 25% credit rate overcomes the problem with a 22.5% tax rate. That having been said, I think, you know, you're right. In general, the higher the credit, the more investment we can expect. The problem of this, you know, you as a policymaker have to come to call with is, at what point have you given sufficient incentive that something should be happening? At what point is it? Have you not struck a good balance between the amount of revenue that's coming in from the oil and the incentive to go out and create more opportunities to produce oil?
Does that answer your question, yes. Senator Hoffman?
On the private royalty tax rate, again, what this bill does is it doesn't have any geographic distinctions in it that we could find between areas. What instead you have is a 5% royalty rate on oil, and one-third of that, or 1.67, on gas. To explain, in the royalties, because the royalties are on gross value, because the royalty owner doesn't generally have to deal with the cost of production, you can do a simple tax rate that's different for oil and gas. In the PPT itself, because it's on a net, you can't do things that simply, and that's why we have a slightly more involved mechanism. One point to note on page 28, what this asks for is that the commissioner report back. I believe it's within 8 years, and talk about what the effect of these rates have been on equity of the tax distribution and other effects. The progressivity surcharge, I've actually got some graphs later on that I'm going to talk about, but again, let me just focus in on the main piece here. The issue here is that, unlike the prior two, the resources versions, the progressivity feature here is driven off of the, what I'll call the net value, the value after the deduction of all the expenses.
Right.
Yes, Senator Bundy.
Yeah, and I don't know if you, Dan, or someone could give us a little broader understanding of the change from gross to net here. I'd be a little concerned about gaming possibilities under net. And when I say that, I don't say that in a derogatory fashion. I expect corporations to make all the money they can make for their stockholders. That's their job.
So Center Monday, we call those tax planning opportunities.
Okay, and it's like our job to make all the money we can for the state, and I don't think they think we're evil for doing that.
Senator Bundy, I think that the cleanest way to describe this is if you had two situations, one in which, let's say, the oil price like it is today essentially is kissing $70, and but you're developing a very difficult field to develop, and so your total costs are $20 a barrel. So when you look at the netting out there, you say, okay, I've got $50 of $50 left after subtracting those costs. In a similar situation, if I have $55 oil, but all I'm doing is transporting it to location, I'm not doing any further layout, any further investment, let's say it's an old investment, I've recovered my investment, those two are going to come out at the same place if you're considering all the costs. If you were just looking at the driver, the oil price, you'd say, oh my gosh, look, it's $70, people make money hand over fist, let's put a high progressivity factor on. At 55, we need to rein back some. So what I think this bill tries to do on the progressivity factor by recognizing those costs is it's trying to equalize those situations. So I think that is a legitimate way of thinking about this, that what the progressivity is being driven by is not the price, but the price minus all your costs, or you know, the positive cash flow, or the profit, however you want to characterize that, that's driven, that's arrived at. Now, what you bring up is are there ways that this can be gamed, and you know, the problem is going to be as you have the price moving around with quite a bit of volatility. Can someone looking at that say, well, I'm going to look at my costs carefully and make sure I'm doing the same things? So if from the end of the year to the beginning of the year you have we have had situations where you can have a $20 price change that will drive that will take an additional 1 or 2% added onto your tax rate, and so you say, well, gee, I ought to be spending all my costs in the month in which I have the higher tax rate, so I'm showing less the tax, pull them out of the ones in which I have the very little. The problem really probably isn't going to be so much when you spend it as getting into arguments about what, you know, sent out the invoice, when did this occur, when did the actual payment make. You can get into those kinds of arguments, and I think you're quite right. That is the drawback to this. It can add a huge layer of complexity. I would make the observation it makes sense with all due respect to my friends the economists, the economics of this makes sense, but it may be more difficult to do, and I think that just the extra amount of difficulty is probably going to be measured by does it in fact produce the favorable economic effect you're looking for. If you have two people at high prices, it's going to affect the person that's made the investments less than someone who's not investing. At low prices or at moderate prices, someone who is having these additional outlays may not be paying any progressivity factor at all, whereas someone who's not making investments may in fact end up paying the progressivity factor sooner.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
I guess my concern might be is, you know, how sharp a pencil are they going to use if we're very economical or we're doing things as economically as we can, and we're just going to end up losing what we save and by being good managers in a tax. Why be as productive as we can or as good managers as we can?
Again, Senator Bundy, through the chair, so many of these questions are a trade-off between accuracy and simplicity, and I think you've correctly identified it. I do think that the cost of administering it, while it may run higher, probably are dwarfed by the actual changes that would occur by adopting a cost factor. In other words, I don't think there's a one-to-one trade-off. Problem is, of course, is we have to come to you every year and appeal for the dollars for the administration. Again, I think if what you're trying to aim for is creating the incentives for investment and making sure that the investors are the folks that are in fact paying less tax as compared to those who aren't, I think this probably is a feature you ought to look at very seriously.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Senator East, please.
Yes, sir. It is. On the record? Okay, Dan.
Madam Chair, if I might go back to the very first page, I don't want to leave any misimpressions, and so if we could just go back to the boxes here. I think it's very, very important, and I hope I didn't mislead anyone. The five credits are only applicable against the base PPT. So even though you've calculated a tax on private royalty, these credits can only reduce your base PPT. They cannot be used to reduce your progressivity. So in that situation, the progressivity will always be there standalone. And in some ways, on the private royalty, again, the credits can't be applied against it. The progressivity is not applied against the private royalty. It really is standalone. So all these really are features that apply to the PPT portion of this.
I do have one announcement to make. I've been asked to announce that the Senate Finance version P that we're working on right now will be posted on akrepublicans.org by 2 p.m. this afternoon. And the material we're going through that has been passed out this afternoon will be posted on the internet as soon as possible after this meeting. So anyone who is not in the room but wants to get direct contact with this will be able to as soon as we can get it online. Thank you. Go ahead. Did you have a question, Senator Olson?
No, I just had a comment. I was talking to.
Okay, very good.
Make the comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. Going on down this list, it says the next question is special gas progressivity. And the answer is no, there is no special rule for gas progressivity. I think what you'll find or what you'll see is that when you are calculating the progressivity, you're looking at all the activity of the particular producer. And if a producer were, say, gas only, you'd be in a situation where they wouldn't come anywhere near the progressivity triggers that we see now. And so I don't think you need to worry about it in a situation there that a progressivity would be applied inappropriately. I think it is true, and it's worth pointing out, that if you are a oil producer, you got mostly oil, and you do have some small portion of gas, in fact, there might be a progressivity charge applied against that. The only point is you'd be looking at total profit before you're applying it, so the gas will sort of drag that down, but then it'll have something extra applied against it. But in general, I think for the folks generally are either mostly gas or are, you know, gas forms a small part of their portfolio.
Okay. Thank you.
The progressivity is expressly not a deduction. Of course, that makes sense if you're going to the base and you say, well, you apply it to the base, but you have to subtract it from the base, and you get into simultaneous linear equations and lose that one. So, Madam Chair, that's sort of the first box of issues. On the transition, what was in this bill reflects the Senate resources version. There is a date change. In other words, you go out 7 years to recoup. So, of course, because this bill had a different start date, also that 7 years is a different date. And just to reiterate, when the credit rate, the general credit rate in the bill changed from 20 to 25, the specific allowance here stayed at 20. Excuse me, I shouldn't use the word allowance to confuse people. The specific credit rate stayed at 20. So on the transitional investment expenditures, for every dollar of investment made and matched 2-to-1 during the recoupment period, you can take 20-cent credit against your liability otherwise owing. Going down to the base allowance, what we've done here, and I've got some more paper on it a little bit later on, what you see here is 5,000 barrels, which was the same figure that was in the Senate Resources version. However, there, if you had additional production, the number of barrels that you could use fell off, and once you hit 33,000, you received no barrel allowance. What this does is everybody gets 5,000 barrels. Now, if I'm a large producer, ConocoPhillips is the largest producer these days, that's going to maybe be one, roughly speaking, 1% of their total production. So as a percentage of production, it obviously, 5,000 declines very dramatically, but everyone gets the 5,000 barrels. However, there is a cap, and the credit is capped at $14 million. If you were using the tax rate, the 22.5%, and you wanted to compare this to the governor's bill, if you recall, the governor had an allowance of $73 million. This translates into roughly $62 million. So it appears to be similar in its effect on the smallest producers, who will have 100% of their production covered, on the largest producers, who will simply be sort of capped at the maximum amount. The place where at least looking at it appears this will be different are the medium-sized producers, the producers in the 20 to 40,000 barrel range, and the largest producers when prices are fairly low. The 5,000 barrel equivalent will cap them. And I've got some more material on that later, so you can see kind of how those distributions are. And again, what this requires is it sunsets in 2016 in 10 years, but in the session before the sunset, the Commissioner of Revenue will bring a report to you and either recommend that you continue this or don't, or point out what's happened as a consequence of it or what hasn't happened. But the notion is, if it's going to sunset, I think it's a very good idea to have folks know that it'll be studied. It's not just going to go away. People are going to look at it, and if it's made sense and done the things it's supposed to do, that it might very well continue. The governor's bill, as you know, did not have a sunset to that particular provision, that comparable provision. On the next box down, the safe harbor, this reflects a 95% threshold, the same as the Senate Resources bill. The only difference is it actually runs for a period. There's an annual true-up instead of a quarterly true-up, and the annual true-up occurs at the time when we think the producer will actually have more information. There's interest only. There are no automatic penalties. Obviously, any time if a producer underpays, and we believe it was due to negligence or something like that, penalties can be asserted.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And under this scenario, you said that they would be paying at 11%. So say that under the CS, they pay 90% after all the calculations. They would pay 11% on the 5% that wasn't paid?
Senator Hoffman, that's exactly right. Glad you didn't ask me to do that in my head. On the effective date, the effective date is the same effective date which was in the governor's bill, which is roughly 2 months and 10 days from now. And it reflects the same transitional provisions that went after the bill passes. For the next six periods, they pay on the old system. In the seventh month, they then do a true-up with no interest, no penalties. But from then on, the interest and penalties would apply. On the spill surcharge, I believe that the language is identical to the I guess the note we have here is that it was changed to one, the split nickel, the 2-3 was changed to 1-4, but
subject to change.
Don't know if this is
subject to amendment.
Okay, like the Senate Resources version, it is not credible, not deductible. Those are both different than the governor's bill. The SB 185 credit was extended for a period of 10 years. We had discussed at some point also having a report on that. The report, in fact, is not in the CS, and I think the administration would ask, probably put forward an amendment that would ask you also to get a report on that before it just automatically sunsets. There was one issue in that bill that the SB 185 as written said that $20 million worth of credits could be given in Cook Inlet. Unfortunately, it stated in such a way that when $19 million had been given and you had three candidates showing up with claiming $2 million each, it was not clear whether we'd get the first one past the post or the one that we audited first or divide it between the three or, you know. So what we did instead is say, when you hit $20 million, we'll give notice to everyone, and then in the calendar year, following the calendar year, in which that credit's given, we'll pay out any credits and then the program will end. So it really just, you know, there may in fact be more dollars that paid out as a consequence of this, but I think it's a rational way, and for an incentive, people need to know they're going to get it, and this way we think dealt with that language. So that's we're very supportive of that cleanup of the language. On abandonment in general, there was a piece of the abandonment language that used the phrase an extended period of disuse. We simply asked what that meant and how that could be interpreted, and so we're glad to see that that's not in this bill. In addition, there was a series of items, abandonment, restoration, the things that a company must do when they're done with a lease. We believe those are a normal business expense, I think, as the chairman characterized them. It's an ordinary necessary expense, and so those have been a prohibition against those will be recognized just like any other business expense in this CS.
Madam Chair. Could we get a little further explanation on that, and particularly Cook Inlet's lighthouse platforms or platforms that may in the future be lighthouse?
Sure. Well, Senator Stemman, through the chair, in analysis that we've done for valuing for property tax values, it appears to us that there's going to be a critical threshold. I think it's perhaps five platforms. When five platforms are no longer producing, that's when it makes sense to bring the equipment in to actually dismantle, remove those platforms, and reduce them to a state that's acceptable or that meets the conditions of the lease. That could be a fairly hefty amount. And until that time, those platforms are out in Cook Inlet. They're, I think, as you characterize them, lighthouses. They're sort of making sure they're not a navigational hazard, but they're not really producing any additional hydrocarbons for sale.
Good. Then the answer is: does a credit apply or not apply?
25%. Senator Stemman, through the chair. No, generally, let me just say, this would not be a credit would not apply. I mean, a credit applies for a capital expense. A capital expense is an investment you make that you expect to receive a benefit from in future periods. So if you're shutting something down and making it go away, that classically is an expense. It's something you've got to pay out of your pocket, but you're not getting any future benefit for it. So I don't think this would be creditable. No matter what we said in this bill, it wouldn't meet the standards of being a capital expense. What this bill says, or removes the prohibition that was in the Senate Resources CS. What the Senate Resources CS said is, and maybe I'll use the example you just used, if I had a platform and it had been totally dismantled or had stopped producing oil and gas before the date of this bill, and presumably when they did their economics, they knew exactly what they were doing, so they didn't count on any support, and so we won't give them any, quote, incentive. We won't allow this as a deduction. If you had a platform that was had some production from before and some production after, you'd have to divide the cost of abandonment up in that ratio. So if it had been producing for, say, 5 years before and then 2 years after this bill and then shut down, and presuming constant production, you'd go in and you'd say, what numbers I used to, but one part in six was deductible, five parts in six were not. And so that whole section which said you couldn't deduct abandonment for production prior to the bill's passage and you had to go and do an allocation, that whole section was taken out. So it will be allowed, under the CS, under the finance CS, a company will be allowed to deduct their depreciation and their dismantlement, their abandonment costs in calculating their total taxable profit.
I'm just clarifying that. So they get the normal tax deduction. There's no way they can access the credit, 25% credit.
Senator Stedman, through the chair, that's correct.
That answer your question?
Yes.
Senator Bullhead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you know, there's a standing committee that's starting at 1:30 with out-of-town visitors. So out of courtesy of the chairman, I'd like to be at that. So if I could make two requests for information. One structural and the other financial. We had when we originally started on April 1st, we had Mr. Mintz walk through a presentation I found very valuable. I wonder if Mr. Mintz could look at the new bill and pick those pages that are changed in his presentation and let us know the effect of the changes, and if there's anything else in the new bill that he would like to comment on in
He's actually online.
Is he? Okay.
So he's monitoring everything we're
okay.
doing.
Okay. So if he could do a shortened version of what he did for us April 1st. And then from a financial standpoint, the way I see it, out of the big five, we've made four significant changes. And all of those have financial implications. So I would ask that we have Econ 1 do another Table 91, which I found to be very helpful. And again, I'll help you, Madam Chair, chase that down. I talked with Senator Terrio at lunch, and he thought it could be done very quickly, and he was going to check back with me. So those two things pop out if I could. I'd just like to see how all this packages up as they all interact with one another. And with that, I'd like to be excused.
Relief. I want to be sure. Rob? Rob Mintz?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Did you hear the request from Senator Wilkin?
I did. I wasn't sure when this is supposed to take place, though.
Yesterday.
2:30.
What kind of time frame is that going to take to update your navigating CS 305 from April 1st to today's bill?
Well, I'm far from an expert on PowerPoint, if you're looking at tomorrow, I could probably have it done by tomorrow.
That's great. Is that fine, Senator Wilkin?
Oh, yeah, that's great.
Yeah, that's super. Thank you, Rob. What's that, Senator Hoffman?
Was it AM or PM?
Yeah. Either. I'm sure it'd be AM. Rob's pretty good.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, sir.
Senator Wilkin, we actually had started also modeling those large, the big five effects, and hopefully we could compare with what, we'll touch base with.
Sure. With Econ 1. You're good.
Sorry, I lost my place here. I guess the next provision is the credits usable, and I think as I spoke earlier, and I think folks have been fairly consistent across the various versions of this, they are just usable against the PPT. In that sense, the additional tax pieces like the progressivity factor cannot be reduced by a credit. The credits are not refundable in this bill. If there is an annual loss, for example, if you're an explorer that doesn't have production yet or very little production, you carry that forward at the same tax rate that you would have had. So that's really just a mechanics question. If you carry it forward from month to month, the effect will be 22.5. And if you carry it from the end of the year to the next year, it's also the same effect.
Yes, Senator Stedman.
Just a point of clarification because we're still trying to get caught up. We still have the 80% limit. Or a 20% maximum reduction of the PPT tax owed using purchased credits?
Senator Stedman, through the chair, thank you very much. Yes, and it's the line, I just skipped it. You're absolutely right. It's the line between the credits usable and the credit refundable line there.
Okay, thank you.
Limited 20%. My apologies. Going on, the point of production has remained constant, although we have been working that over this weekend with some other taxpayers and hoping we can maybe clarify something which will reduce ambiguity, suggest an amendment to someone that we would appreciate that when we get that done. On the DNR or royalty value, again, this is the notion that when we look at gross value at the point of production, since those are already being calculated under the DNR rules? Could we save some administration efforts by doing that once? We've essentially adopted the language from the Senate CS, where that simply said the commission will make a determination first based on the fiscal interest of the state. We suggested language that was a little more focused, basically said a trade-off between efficiency and making sure that there was no a bias downward. We can look at the exact language.
And are not biased toward understating a producer's tax liability.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Exactly right. This bill does not have the provisions for using Internal Revenue Code Section 482 as a tool for dealing with transfer pricing. It does, however, have simplified language that does say that in the case of a transfer pricing or a non-arm's length transaction, amounts above fair market value are not a direct cost and therefore would not be deductible. So it is trying to get to the same point. It's doing it with a tool that we think ultimately will be more usable. On the catastrophic oil spill deductible, this bill does not mention it, and therefore, presumably, as long as it's an ordinary and necessary expense, it would be. Several provisions that have been added that were not in prior ones, prior versions of the bill. The first one was in SB 185, and generally what it said is when you're doing exploration expenses and you're receiving these credits, that information needs to be turned over to the Department of Natural Resources, where it will be kept for 10 years, at which point it will become public information available to other explorers who may want to look at that same area. So we've simply taken that language and we made the one correction to it that we suggested, but you just see the same language that was in Section 025 now applies to all exploration data. In 020F, there was a clarification made. I think Rob will probably touch on this more when he goes through every line of it. But basically, it's just to try to more precisely reflect current practice that was updated. Another section that has some additional clarifying language was originally the bill said when you're looking at upstream costs, you would look at industry practice and Department of Natural Resources regulations. This just says you first look at industry practice. If that's not clear or ambiguous, then you move on to the Department of Natural Resources regulations. And then the last line on here is one we talked about, which is the gas revenue exclusion. So, Madam Chair, that's the quick summary from the table.
Are there questions? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And do you see any problem in putting in a severability clause in this legislation?
Excuse me, the
severability.
I would have to defer to an attorney on that issue.
I'm going to ask the question. Okay. Any other questions? Senator Sedman.
Just a clarification on the first page of the handout when we list the five credits, mm-hmm. So some of the boys don't get too excited here. I think the second and third one, the third and fourth one are mutually exclusive. You come down to the third one where it's alternative exploration credit up to 40%. If my understanding then in this bill, if you access that because you qualify for the exploration credit, you do not get the qualified capital expenditure of 25, is that right?
Senator Sedman, that's absolutely correct. For any given dollar, it couldn't appear in both. However, when someone's filling out their return, they might have some under 024 and some under 025. But any dollar of expenditure, you get one or the other. Absolutely correct.
Other questions?
Madam Chair, if I could just go through the rest of the package, and these are several things that we were able to pull together. The first one is simply, and I apologize for the lack of titles here, but a lot of focus has been on the private royalty interests, and I think appropriately so from the point of view of the folks having those leases. But what this tries to show is, in fact, what percentage of production comes from such private leases. Now, one of the points I need to footnote very carefully here, I don't think it has a substantial effect, is we were able to look at, with DNR's help, we looked at all the units and participating areas that have some state or federal in it. There's a handful of small ones that don't, that are totally private, but I don't think those would really affect the statistical picture at all. And the quick point here is oil production. There is no oil production from private royalty interests in the Cook Inlet. On the North Slope, you will see over on the right-hand side, it is generally about less than 0.5%. Occasionally, it's more than 0.5%, but it is a fraction of a percent. It's actually larger than the federal piece. The federal piece is also very small. And as we all, I think, are aware, on the North Slope, most of the production is coming from the state leases, 98, 99% plus. So for oil, as you can see, the private royalty interests are less than 1% of the total. Moving down to gas production, there you see that, in fact, in the Cook Inlet, you have 5 or 6% of the gas production coming from private, or exists in the final year up to as much as 10%. Nonetheless, the total gas production from the Cook Inlet, as compared to the oil production on the North Slope, is in itself about 5 or 6%. So this is when you see gas production, 10% of a much smaller number. And on the North Slope, you see so far no production from gas, no gas production from private leases. So all this table does, it doesn't really illustrate anything in particular about the bill, but it just gives, I think, people a sense of how large or small a role the private royalty leases play within the entire tax the entire production structure, and that's the tax structure. Again, they're very important to people who hold them, but overall, they're not a major part of the production picture. Moving on to the next page. There was some question, and I guess in particular, if you look at the bill, the CS, I think it was on page 6, line 26, and it basically says, gee, if you've taken a credit for an expenditure under, and then it just kind of lists four statutes across, you will not qualify under 024. And what I did is I went out, and this is a page out of DNR's excellent handbook they put out every year, their annual report, and it simply lists the exact four other credits, the four credit programs. And so if people wanted a sense of what those were, this will give that to them. So I'm not going to read it or anything, but if people want that as a background source, that's off of DNR's website.
That's great. Thank you.
Madam Chair, what the next graphic does, is it presents in sort of visual form what is happening to the per barrel progressivity surcharge. What this does is we've taken a sample year, in this case 2010, so we've got the volumes and the spending from that, or our estimated spending from that year, estimated volumes too, obviously, and we say for every barrel, how much additional money will be paid as a consequence of the progressivity feature. So, let's just take today's price and see if today's price were the average price throughout 2010. What you see here is the top line, the blue diamonds, is under the House bill, and under the House bill, every barrel would bear about $5 of additional tax as a consequence of the progressivity feature when the ANS price was $70. The next, the boxes down, the red boxes are the Senate Resource CS, and it looks like that'd be about maybe $3.50 or $4 a barrel additional would be paid as a consequence of that progressivity feature. And finally, the triangles, the brown triangles, are the Senate Finance, the CS in front of us, and that looks like it'd be something on the order of magnitude of $1 or 90 cents paid at $70 price. Now, of course, one important thing is we have here, roughly speaking, I think in this model, about effectively $15 in costs. So the difference really is, at $70, we're saying that the profit being made on that barrel, or the dollars available on that barrel, is more like 55. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you look down, I think you'll see that, that for example, at $55, that's about what you would be paying under the Senate resource version. So it's not precisely, it doesn't calibrate precisely because they also have slightly different slopes, and I think at the request of Senator Hoffman will be running some of those different slopes to show you. But the notion here is we have the ANS price shown as the driver, and in fact is the driver for the Senate version and the House version and the Senate resources CS. It's only indirectly the driver for the Finance Committee version because, of course, costs matter there. I think in some sense this gets a little bit, if you cover up what's happening on the left-hand side, I think in some sense this answers Senator Huffman's question about a 3% versus a 2% versus a 1%, and sort of what those three different curves will look like. Obviously, obviously for folks who have looked at the House bill, they have a feature at $1, $110.01, in which their rate increases dramatically. This CS does not have that, nor did the prior CS. But that this lays out, and in some senses, it may be hard to see, but you have different starting points at the $40, $45, $50. So there is some small, the progressivities act differently in that range, and maybe it'd be useful to have a blow-up graph because that's in fact where you expect a lot of the activity to be occurring at those different pieces. So maybe when we come back, I'll try to get the left-hand one-third of this blown up to see some of the differences. But I think this does give you a dramatic sense of the differences that would occur at the prices we we hope to see, but we won't be counting on.
Senator Bundy.
Thank you. And this chart doesn't go far enough to the left beyond $120 a barrel, but I suppose sometime in the future that could be foreseeable. The House plateaus after 110 and doesn't increase. The other two continue to increase no matter what the price.
Senator Bundy, that's correct. You can sort of extrapolate out in some place over here they'd cross.
Thank you.
Any questions? Oh, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, in 2010, is this a base case or low or high scenario?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, I believe it is the low volume case. Having said that, I don't believe that that's going to have any effect because what this tries to do is say per barrel.
And do you know what the production level would be in 2010?
Not off the top of my head, I could probably look it up, but
I would agree with you. We need to look at what happens between zero and $50 under these different scenarios. That would be real helpful because probably that's going to be the
cockpit of what things happen
for the next few years.
Senator, through the chair, we have 780,000 barrels a day showing for 2010.
Are there other questions? Senator Stedman.
Thanks, Madam Chair. It's nice to look at the chart in these dollars, but I assume then we're going to get the chart done in percentages so we can see the government take numbers and then we can see the severance tax area or the PPT area with the status quo on it.
Senator Stedman, in fact, later on in this presentation, we have a chart that we showed you earlier, a form of it where we'd simply taken the Senate resources bill and sort of tacked on a piece of what would happen if you put in the different progressivity. And tomorrow, I hope we can get you a more detailed version that shows that. Excuse me, Madam Chair, if you could turn to the next page, again, I didn't seem to do very well in putting, untitling things and putting this together quickly. But what this does is it looks back at a prior year where we have known production figures, and it says, okay, as I look at the feature, the Senate's finance 5,000 barrels capped at a $14 million credit, look at the governor's bill that was a $73 million allowance, and look at Senate resources that was a $5,000 allowance that dropped off, what the effect of that would be. Now, what I've done here, so on the box on the left-hand side simply looks at barrel of oil equivalent, so it has gas translated into barrel of oil at a 6-to-1 ratio. And what you see are columns at $30, $40, $50, $60, $70. I used the 22.5 when we were throwing this together, just it's an arbitrary number. It could be high, could be low. Angus Walker had spoken to you about BP and said at 22.50 that's where they break even, so that would be a proxy for their costs there. So if 22.50 was the total expense, then the total cost outlay, this would show you what was left after those. So what this simply says is, given these three different mechanisms, the mechanism under Senate Finance, under the governor's bill, and the Senate resource, how much of the taxable profit will be shielded by this mechanism? And I think the important thing to look at is, under all the bills, under all three bills, fundamentally the folks with the smallest production, under 5,000 barrels a day, all have no tax liability. And I think that's a feature of all three. But that's where they differ. From then on, things are different. If you look at the bill in front of you, what you will see is, generally, as you produce more, the size of the shield decreases, and so everyone's getting 5,000 barrels. But again, if you have ConocoPhillips producing 400,000 barrels a day, 5,000 barrels is a much smaller part of their production than say an Anadarko or a Marathon, and these percentages simply reflect that. What you don't necessarily see is, you do see it, as you move from right to left, you will see that I've put a total figure on there. So how much is the total? And you can see it stays fairly constant at 4 and then starts to drop off. That's simply the effect of the $12 million cap kicking in. And so...
$14 million?
$14 million. Excuse me, Madam Chair. I get these, got so many versions got running around in my head. So $12 million in the House bill, but this is $14. Thank you very much. And so that's why you see that percentage declining. Comparing this, if I might, to the governor's bill, where you will see, again, smaller producers at 100, the decline there starts at the lowest of prices, and as prices rise, the amount sheltered declines. But because it's a simple shield of dollars and there's no barrels involved, you simply see a decline going down. Simply as prices rise, the amount of coverage declines. The Senate Resources version, basically, if you look at that, again, small producers pay 100% of their production was shielded for the smallest producers. But the flip side of that is any producer that was producing more than 30,000 barrels a day received no shield as a consequence of this. So what this really was targeted at was a narrow, at least in the current today, a narrow range of folks that had production between 5,000 and 30,000. You can see that it was fairly price insensitive, but as a whole, the amount shielded here was much, much smaller, more like 1%. So I hope this to show you here the difference between the Senate Finance and the governor's bill and the Senate Resources bill. So compared to the governor's bill, again, in short, large producers and the smallest producers at all but at moderate prices has the same effect. The only place you really see a difference are at some of the more moderate prices.
Other questions? Thank you.
And again, we'll try to put gross dollars on this for tomorrow's presentation.
Okay.
And finally, the last slide in this package is one, and I want to be very, very clear about this because it's not, people may jump to a quick conclusion here. This was done, it has taken the 2520, in other words, the Senate resources bill, and simply grafted on the progressivity function from this CS. So the baseline, the number that's in red that you see here, and again, this is the distribution of cash flows, how much of the cash flows in a year goes to the state. You'll see the baseline there is not the bill we're looking at today, but is the Senate resources version. The red line that takes off, if you will, at the $40 level and shows a steadily increasing government take as prices increase, going from 60% up to about 64%, is the progressivity factor found in the Senate Resources Bill. The blue line, which sort of lays on top of the red line, if you will, up until you hit about $60, and then rises slightly after that, represents the progressivity feature found in the CS in front of you, grafted onto the bill. So this was a part of what we were requested to do by Senator Steadman, and what he's also requested is we complete the assignment, and so you can see the entire effect of what happens with the CS that you have in front of you. The relationships will look the same, but it will be shifted as a consequence of the different tax rates.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Other questions? Senator Steadman.
Madam Chairman, if I remember correctly, the change in the government take number should decline about 1.1%, and it varies over the price ranges. So just as a general ballpark expectation, we can take those numbers and decline them.
1.1?
Somewhere in there. Mm-hmm. And the chart that's going to come back to us should
just slope right underneath there.
Right, fairly close. Mm-hmm. That's what I'd expect to see, but we'll find out when we get it done.
Oh, Senator Bundy.
Yeah, thank you. If I remember correctly, at a 2020, the net tax was about 9%, including the credit and the actual tax.
It's about 9%?
Nine.
I think, okay, let me hear your question. I'm going to.
Okay, yeah, 2520, the net was actually about 12 when you include the net. It would be interesting to know what the net would be at 22.5 versus 25. And I'm not sure where we got that information. It may have been
Senator Bundy
Johnson or Econ One.
Senator Bundy, through the chair. In fact, that was part of what Senator Steadman had requested earlier, to show the effective tax rates.
Okay.
From just the tax alone, not the total government take.
Yeah. I guess in my mind, I was thinking the difference between 25. You've got the two numbers, and I was thinking about the first number, whether it's 22.5 or 25, but I don't think we've ever discussed what the net impact would be on the credit side going from 20 to 25, mm-hmm. And so if we could have that in the calculations. And by the way, I appreciate you rushing this out. No apologies necessary for lack of titles. I appreciate getting information.
Had a lot of support from the folks in the tax division in that support.
Any questions? Oh, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the graph, right above $40, the difference between the Senate Finance Program and the blue line and the 2520 with no progressivity, that point where they depart at 60.9%, is that accurate with the definition of the change in the progressivity at with the net value calculation?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, make sure I get this question right. At $40, the Senate resources version has no progressivity, so that's why the two are identical. As you move, $40.01, you'll start to accrue it. So the next data point plot on here is at $50, and you've moved from 60.9 up to 61.7. I think, and then if you make the same calculation, and these are at $10 increments, I think what this is saying,
but progressivity under the Senate Finance Committee version, wouldn't that start out much higher than $40?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, correct. And if you look at the graph, what you will see is that $60, they're identical, and then it's at $70 that they've started to diverge. And you just have to look at what the costs were in the model, and I think that they are about at $15 here. So if you looked at $45 plus 15, it'd be about 60. So you'd expect them to diverge very quickly after that data point, or maybe about that data point.
So the versions with regard to progressivity, even with the different definitions, don't kick in till after $60.
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, again, what we're modeling here is a sort of an overall on the North Slope model. But if you had an entity which had no costs, let's just take for a minute that they're very low operating costs, and that could kick in at a much lower level. For the 45, if you look in the bill itself, the actual trigger on page 4, line 17 is 45. So if I had $5 worth of costs at $50 price, subtract my $5, that's what it would take to trigger it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there other questions? Okay, we'll have a brief, please. Okay, we're back on the record. Okay, we passed out another sheet that expresses some of the information we had on another graph a while ago. It says it a little differently, and it's kind of interesting to see how this plays out. Dan, you want to walk us through this?
I will. And Madam Chair, someone who's quick will look at this and compare it to the other graph and say, wait a minute, there's a difference here of a dollar. What's going on? The graph that is presented here, the color, the graphic, is a is based on running the actual model, has all effects taken into it. The spreadsheet you see in front of you is a very simplistic way of looking at it, and perhaps should be used more to indicate sort of a trend and differences between the two, as opposed to an actual exact dollar figure.
And the one on the left is the Senate Finance.
It's absolutely correct. The one on the left is the bill that the CSHM in front of you, and what this says is what happens is, again, it's the function of two things. One of them is the absolute, the market price of the ANS where it gets sold, mm-hmm. and that would be across the top, 50, 55, 60, 65. What's down the left-hand column is the total per barrel cost. I want to make clear, this would be the upstream costs, this would be the downstream cost, this would be the exploration that has been re-expressed. So this is really just trying to get to a general sense of how much per barrel would be deducted if we were trying to put this on a per barrel basis. So what this formula would do is you would look, and let's take, for example, at the $60 level, and we'd assume for a minute that we had $15 of costs. So we go halfway down at $15. Well, if you subtract 15 from 60, you come out with 45. And therefore, as you'd expect in the formula, which says you take any profits over 45, there's nothing payable. It comes out to zero. As you move across, you can see that you have the
on page 4.
Excuse me, Madam Chair. Exactly. That's page 4, line 17. It's section H, which sets up this formula.
Okay.
What happens as the price increases by $5, you will add 25 cents for each barrel. Again, assuming that costs stay constant, you've raised some questions with us about whether that's a good assumption or not, and over the long term it probably isn't, but short term it probably is. So as it increases $5, it goes up a quarter. As it goes up another $5, you can see it goes up another quarter plus, it goes up to 55 cents, so it's a larger increase. Increases by another $5, it goes up to 90 cents. So the increase, as the price increases, so too does the, it goes up more than proportionally. It's not a quarter for every $5. And so as prices rise, you will see that the price, the progressivity factor increases. Now, the general structure here, of course, continuing looking at $60, is if there were heavy investing going on and your cash flow was sort of depleted as a consequence of that, so anything above $15, progressivity would not kick in. On the other hand, if prices, you were making those investments and prices went up to, say, by $10 to $70, then your threshold would move down to $25. So I think what you see is this sort of diagonal cut across the spreadsheet that shows at lower prices, it cuts a combination of a low price and a high investment will yield no progressivity factor. A high price in that same investment might have a progressivity, but by the same token, if you are a low price and a much lower investment, also would not have any progressivity attached to it. I think part of the reason this may be a little bit skewed, or as people think about it, is the going across the top, those are increments of $5, whereas going down the left-hand side, it's increments of $1 each. Let me compare that.
Yeah, just if I might. Thank you, Madam Chair. We've heard the cost of producing a barrel of oil. I think a broad average is about $12 a barrel, but there's some clear up to $20 a barrel. So in oversimplifying again, if we were to take $12 a barrel cost of oil, the CS we have before us would raise the taxes by $1.56. Versus the House bill, which would be $4.50, and of course at a $20 a barrel cost, it's $90 and $4.50. Okay, thank you.
And Senator Bundy, I think the point, just moving over to the right hand side, if you look, let's just say at that $60 level, if someone has made there's a great deal of investment being made. You would pay the same increment as if no investment were being made. In other words, it is insensitive to the cost. The only driver is the dollar price per barrel, the sales price, the value in the market. And as you can see, each column is exactly the same value going down.
But there's no sensitivity at all.
There's no sensitivity to cost in that.
If I might, and then at the more expensive fields, like the $20 a barrel cost. Oil would have to be up $70 a barrel before there'd be any progressivity actually at all.
Under the CS in front of you, that's exactly right. If you had a heavy oil or someplace like that had the very heavy costs, you wouldn't kick in until you were, as you say, up in the $75 range.
Thank you.
Although, Senator, if I might observe, obviously what's going to happen for any taxpayer, it's going to be the average of everything.
I'm sorry.
For any taxpayer, they'll be paying an average. The progressivity sort of won't be calculated on a field-by-field basis.
Yeah.
It would be.
And so the actual number is apt to be between 12 and 20.
Okay. Are there other questions? Are there other information? Is there other information we would like to have furnished to us tomorrow other than what you've already heard? The redo of the April 1 presentation.
Senator Bundy. Well, not that I desire more public testimony, but are we going to hear from producers about their reaction to the Senate CS? Well, it would, might be interesting to hear, at least from, I suppose if you open up to our, we're going to have tons of public testimony, but I was just thinking of a representative small producer and a representative large, that, to, so we could get the big small perspective again.
Well, hopefully we can.
Or maybe just get some of that in writing.
Could be.
That might be the easier thing to do. If I could just make the request, any of the companies involved in this would like to share with us in writing their reaction to the Senate Finance version, that would be interesting reading.
Yeah, okay. Well, let me kind of check the timing on everything. We may well have time to do that, because I know we're on a very ambitious time frame here. And I'm certainly not trying to overlook anyone. I just, we'll take a brief recess. As a reminder, we do have bills before us tomorrow morning and tomorrow afternoon. I do invite any producers, any interested persons, independents, owner operators, to let us know what your reaction is to this. And I do not know at this point if we'll be able to have actual testimony, but we will consider if you will get your reactions to this to us in writing, in as brief a form as you can, and or as, you know, direct as you can. And we'll certainly try to incorporate what we can into what we're doing. And any questions from any of the members? Any additional information required? We'll probably get back to this tomorrow afternoon. After bills scheduled to be heard. I don't think they're going to, the afternoon bills are going to take that long. Famous last words. Anything further to come for the committee? We're adjourned.